From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Brain scans that detect abnormalities are being used as evidence in criminal trials in an attempt to show that the defendant was not in complete control of his actions. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Jeffrey Rosen. His article on how brain science could transform our legal system was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Larry Devlin was the CIA agent in the Congo when the country's first elected prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, was assassinated in 1960. Devlin has been accused of being behind the assassination. In his new memoir, he denies it, but he does say he was assigned to do it. We'll talk with him. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brain scans are increasingly being admitted as evidence in criminal trials to suggest that an impairment in the brain caused the defendant to commit the crime. This emphasis on neuroscientific evidence is being called neurolaw. My guest Jeffrey Rosen wrote an article on neurolaw and how brain science could transform our legal system. It was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Rosen is the legal affairs editor at the New Republic and a professor of law at George Washington University Law School. His latest book is called The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Jeffrey Rosen, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the ways that MRIs and other forms of brain scans are being used now as evidence in criminal trials?
Right now, they're being introduced in death penalty litigation. Some lawyers have said that it's almost de rigueur in a death penalty case to introduce evidence that the defendant's amygdala made him do it. Now, this comes in generally at sentencing, after someone has already been convicted. And the standards for introducing evidence at sentencing are very low. If there's any plausible relevance, the stuff comes in. So generally, it comes in. It doesn't always change the outcome. But in some cases, brain evidence has persuaded jurors to sentence someone to life rather than death. And both proponents and skeptics think that it'll really increase as time goes on.
What are some of the typical problems that the brain scans are capable of showing that are introduced as evidence in the trials?
More and more, defense lawyers are arguing that people's brain made them do it. One example was told to me by Reuben Gurr, who teaches psychology at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He began a career as an expert witness in the 1990s when a colleague asked him to talk about the trial of a convicted serial killer in Florida called Bobby Joe Long. He was called the classical ad rapist. He responded to classified ads placed by women and then raped and killed them. Terrible series of crimes. He was sentenced to death there after he committed at least 9 murders in Tampa. Gurr is called as a national expert in PET scan or positron emission tomography. And after examining Long's PET scans, Gurr testified that a motorcycle accident that left Long in a coma had severely damaged his amygdala, and it was after emerging from that coma that Long committed his first rape. So Gurr basically tried to argue that the damaged amygdala made Long into the monster that he was. The testimony was admitted. Gurr said he didn't think it had a profound impact. The case is still being appealed. But Gurr has testified in more than 20 capital cases since then, and he believes that this evidence is more and more sought after.
How does this relate to the insanity defense?
The insanity defense, for a long time in Anglo-American jurisprudence, has held people responsible for their actions unless they're unable to appreciate the difference between right and wrong. That standard came from a famous case called the Monoton case in the 1840s, where a paranoid British assassin was excused from responsibility because he was unable to appreciate the difference between right and wrong. What the brain scan evidence does is introduce the possibility that someone may be able to understand the difference between right and wrong, but may still be unable to control themselves in some sense. In other words, if all of our actions are predetermined by our brains, you may be rational enough to know that what you're doing is wrong, but not be able to stop yourself from doing it anyway. And that's why the most enthusiastic proponents of this brain evidence suggest that it would require us to rethink the whole notion of insanity and criminal responsibility, and not punish people because they're bad in some sense, because they deserve to be held accountable for their freely chosen actions. Instead, the idea is you can keep people off the streets if they're dangerous, in the same way that a car without brakes could hurt someone. But the whole idea of ascribing moral responsibility to a freely choosing agent, these people claim, is no longer tenable.
So if you follow that through, what would the implications be for the way we punish people in prison now?
I think that some proponents of this evidence say that retribution, which has been the focus of American criminology ever since the 1970s, should go out the window. It doesn't make sense to say that you're a bad person who deserves to be punished. It doesn't even make sense to try to send society a message that this sort of conduct deserves to be punished, because we're all in some sense automatons who have the illusion of making free choices between soup and salad or between virtue and vice. But this really is an illusion. It's our brain signals are compelling us to act in particular ways in some deep sense, and therefore Rehabilitation may not make much sense either. The main focus of criminology, according to these proponents, should simply be deterrence, keeping dangerous people off the streets.
How? Does that mean, like, if you have a cyst on your brain that you're not allowed to leave the house? I mean, like, how do you do that?
Well, it's not a trivial question at all. I mean, in the most obvious sense, you could just lock someone up in prison for a long time if they're dangerous. But all sorts of questions arise. Should people be locked up not only for crimes that they've already committed, but for crimes that they might commit? This is something that American law has struggled with in the context of civil commitment of sexual offenders right now. You can keep someone locked up not to punish them, but to prevent them from committing future sex crimes. But imagine, as brain scans became more precise, if you could identify a spot on someone's brain that suggested that they might be likely to commit certain kinds of crimes in the future, could you lock them up not because of something they've done in the past, but because of something they might be likely to do in the future? That obviously poses a fundamental challenge to the basic idea of Anglo-American jurisprudence, that you're responsible for what you do, not for what you think. And the idea of preventative detention based on future proclivities is just one of the deepest and most troubling implications of this new technology.
And I guess this raises the question over whether privacy issues and laws protecting privacy would be extended to the brain.
It really does. And as a privacy junkie, I have to say that my mind reels at the range of issues that are presented by this technology and that people have barely begun to think about. Can you get a search warrant for someone's brain? Can you compel them to take a brain lie detector test that reveals them to be telling the truth? Can you, moving closer to science fiction, engage in a kind of memory downloading where you could basically read out someone's brain and have pictures or an audio account of things that they've seen in the distant past? Is a brain scan like a stomach pump, which the court has said in some circumstances shocks the conscience if it's done in a particularly egregious circumstance? Or is it more like a blood sample, which the court has said you can get because it doesn't really invade privacy? These range of issues, even the experts themselves have only begun to think about. There are no clear answers in the courts, and it really will keep the privacy people, as well as the rest of us, busy for a long time to come.
Well, to understand more about what's involved here, you submitted yourself to a couple of brain scans to see what they could learn about your brain. Tell us about one of those tests.
Well, it was really quite an experience. This was administered by my friend and law school classmate, Owen Jones, who is turning Vanderbilt University into the Los Alamos of neurolaw. He's this very energetic and enthusiastic proponent of these technologies. So he offered to make me one of his first subjects for an experiment that he calls harm and punishment. He's trying to look at people's brains as they assign imaginary punishments to a range of criminals and see the way the different parts of the brain interact, the emotional centers in the amygdala and the more deliberative centers of the prefrontal cortex. So I went down to Vanderbilt and saw their fancy new center, a $27 million center, which was very impressive, and went down into the magnet, as they call it. I know many people have had fMRIs. I hadn't before. It's not a portable technology. This thing is not ready for use in airports to detect terrorists by any means. This huge metal object, you put on a metal head cage to keep your head from moving. They really impressed on me the necessity of being as still as possible and not even moving an eyebrow. So you get in and you have a panic button and everything is dark, and then a series of imaginary punishment scenarios are flashed before your eyes for about 45 minutes, imagining that someone wants to kill his father and tries to electrocute him, but he actually was suffering under delusions and therefore should be excused. And then you press numbers from 0 to 9, indicating a range of possible punishments, and then stumble outside the scanner. So I did this for a good long time, and then we looked at my brain and saw how the various parts of it were interacting.
And what were they supposed to learn about you through this test?
I think Owen Jones and his colleague Rene Marois were trying to study is, do different people's brains interact in different ways when they read these punishment scenarios? So the first thing they learned about me is that I'm the harshest punisher they ever had. It was a surprise to me, but I assigned higher rates of punishment than other people. But they also found that the prefrontal cortex, which is the deliberative center of the brain, has quite a direct correlation with the level of punishment you'll assign, and that suggested that maybe that center was more important in predicting what kind of juror you would be, what kind of punishments you would assign, and basically how you approach these legal questions.
You know, you took a second MRI test. Why don't you describe that one to us, too?
That was great fun, too. It was simpler. It was thought up on the fly. I asked them to basically show me a test that they hadn't thought of before. And they said, okay, think of faces and places in sequence, but don't tell us which you're thinking of. So I'm sitting in the scanner, and it's very dark and quiet. And I'm very eager to avoid any improper thoughts because I thought they would be discovered on the scanner. So I thought of my wife's face, and then of my living room at home, and then my son's faces, and then my parents' apartment, and in sequence, this went on for some time. And then when I came back the next day, they were smiling broadly, and Renee and Owen said, we think we can tell which one you were thinking of, even though you didn't tell us. And they showed pictures of the face recognition area of the brain lighting up like Christmas whenever I thought of faces. And then there's a place recognition area that was similarly active when I thought of places. And this implication is a pretty straightforward application of the technology because the face and place areas are unusually localized. It's not like there's a chocolate area of the brain or a music area in precisely the same way. But this could have legal implications because imagine that someone claimed never to have been to a training area, a training camp in Afghanistan, and were shown a picture of this particular training camp and the place area lit up. That might suggest that they were lying or not and be useful in terrorism investigations. So it's an extremely rich series of possibilities.
Which leads us to lie detector tests. I mean, lie detector tests sound very primitive compared to what you're describing now. So what are the implications for brain scan technology in terms of how lie detector tests are administered and used in the courtroom?
Well, there are two kinds of lie detection technology right now. One involves something called a P300 wave, which apparently lights up when people recognize things that they've seen before. And that would work much as the way that I described the faces places test, where you could show someone a picture of a particular place and see if this P300 wave could be detected. Another uses fMRI technology and finds that people's brains light up differently when they lie than when they're telling the truth. So the man who invented this test, which is called guilty knowledge, gave subjects a playing card and then told them to lie and say they didn't have it in the scanner and then looked at the way their brains lit up. If you could develop a profile, basically, of what the brain looks like when it lies, precisely how it lights up in this controlled situation, you might be able to administer lie detector tests to people in a legal setting. Now, at the very least, the proponents of this technology, some of whom are trying to market it with wonderful names like No Lie MRI, which is one company, and the other is called CIFOS, they hope that people will just be able to bolster their credibility in legal settings. So if you're in a divorce trial, you say you're telling the truth, you're challenged in this, you can introduce a MRI showing that you're telling the truth. Right now, the technology is at about 80% accuracy, which is similar to the accuracy rate for polygraphs, and that's not considered accurate enough to be admitted in most criminal trials. But the proponents hope that in 5 years they'll get up to the 90% range, which should be accurate enough, and that could be a useful tool.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article on neurolaw was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. His latest book is called The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist and law professor Jeffrey Rosen. We're talking about his article on how brain science could transform our legal system now that brain scans are being used as evidence in criminal trials to make the case that a brain abnormality led to the criminal behavior. The article was the cover story of Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Who are some of the people opposing the increased use of this kind of brain scan technology, and what are their reasons for opposing it?
There are a range of reasons. Certainly, privacy advocates are understandably troubled about the implication of holding people accountable for what they think rather than what they do. And Paul Root-Wolpe at the University of Pennsylvania talked to me very eloquently about these concerns. He serves on the board of an organization called the Center for Cognitive Liberty, and this center is concerned about the implications of future profiling and want to resurrect an idea of mental privacy. They want to talk about the skull as a privacy domain and say that in the past it was merely the inability to look through the skull and see the content of thoughts that protected people from dictatorships and other forms of intrusion. Now that that's a possibility, no longer science fiction, they want the law and also technology to adjust to this, to what they consider to be a brave new world. So that's a series of objections. Another series of critics of brain scan technology comes not so much from those who fear that it's likely to be too intrusive, but those who think that it's overhyped, that basically either the hopes and fears of proponents and skeptics won't materialize, and also that it doesn't really fundamentally require us to rethink our whole idea of responsibility. Stephen Morse at the University of Pennsylvania is especially eloquent on this question. Morse says, what's new about this brain scan technology? There have been a whole series of legal movements in response to technological changes that try to come up with materialistic accounts of human behavior. Law and genetics, for example, or law and psychology, or the Chicago School of Sociology in the 1930s that tried to say that structural situations like people's upbringing could affect their behavior. Moore says this is yet another in a long series of scientific accounts of the roots of behavior. In some ways, it appears more scientific because there are prettier pictures and maybe more likely to sway jurors because we have this illusion of understanding something when we see a picture of the brain lighting up. But it's not fundamentally different from these earlier accounts. And Morse came up with a very powerful challenge, which impressed me. He said, generally, the law holds you criminally responsible unless you act under duress, with a gun to your head, for example, or if you have a serious defect in rationality, you're unable to tell the difference between right and wrong. But the law generally doesn't care why you are unable to tell the difference between right and wrong or you act under duress. It doesn't matter whether it's a bad mommies and daddies, as he put it, or if your amygdala is mucked up. Basically, there's a substantive judgment about the point at which you should be held responsibility for your freely chosen actions. So merely understanding the source of this behavior, said Morse, doesn't mean that the behavior should be excused for those who believe that responsibility is possible. Otherwise, that would mean because all behavior is caused in some sense, all behavior would have to be excused. And that's inconsistent with the premise of the Anglo-American jurisprudence. So Morse, I thought, was a voice of reason. He wasn't claiming that the technology was irrelevant. He said it would lead to modest advances in our understanding of particular behaviors and functions. But the idea that all of our conceptions of responsibility, harm, and punishment would have to be reconsidered, he thought, was an example of what he called brain overclaim syndrome.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Rosen, and we've been talking about an article that he wrote in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, which is called The Brain on the Stand, How Neuroscience is Transforming the Legal System. Jeffrey, you've been writing some really interesting articles, and you had an article that was a cover story in the New Republic called My Vacation in Gitmo, and it was basically about a small press junket that you took of Gitmo that was sponsored by who?
This was sponsored by the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, William Haynes. And he invited a group of seven law professors, journalists, and Bush administration officials to go to Gitmo and reassure ourselves that it wasn't actually Abu Ghraib. He hadn't been for a while, nor had some of the Bush officials. The camp has been reorganized under a new commander. And I think they feel like they've been getting a lot of bad publicity for a long time, and that there's a gap between the lingering images of abuse that we remember from the early days of the now shuttered Camp X-Ray and the reality of Gitmo, which is that it's now being run as a very professional prison. So we were summoned on a couple days' notice, and what a junket it was. Imagine showing up at the Pentagon at 6 in the morning, taking a little van to Andrews Air Force Base, and then really feeling a little bit presidential as you walk across that famous tarmac up to a private jet, a Gulfstream jet, which has United States of America emblazoned on it, soldiers saluting, the sun is rising, and you go into this extraordinarily comfortable plane. The military steward comes around and takes your omelet orders, and all of us were in a very jolly, almost giddy frame of mind for our unexpected little holiday adventure.
What were you taken to see once you got to Gitmo?
We were taken to see first an administration building for a briefing about the camp and the interrogation methods, and then we were taken to see three of the six prisons. There are six of them. Two of them are recently built, and they contain the highest value detainees. The first one, Camp 1, looks very much like a open-air prison, small cells open to each other and to the warm tropical air. Each of the cells has a Quran in it and a arrow pointing toward Mecca. The call to prayer is broadcast five times a day. All of the meals are halal according to Muslim requirements, and we actually ate one of these meals. It was perfectly edible. This was all presented to us as an example of the sensitivity to the religious needs of the prison population and the fact that there was no mental torture taking place.
Jeffrey Rosen's article on Gitmo was the cover story of last week's edition of The New Republic, where he's the legal affairs editor. His latest book is called The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the visual thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From the Joyce Foundation, supporting efforts to educate America's workforce and improve the quality of teaching in low-achieving schools, joycefdn.org. And from Delacorte Press, publisher of All Saints, a novel about a teacher's journey of faith and despair by Liam Callanan, author of The Cloud Atlas. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the CIA agent who in 1960 was assigned to assassinate the Prime Minister of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, but didn't do it. Former CIA Congo Chief of Station Larry Devlin tells us his story. He's written a memoir. And we continue our interview with Jeffrey Rosen. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. He's the legal affairs editor at The New Republic. When we left off, we were talking about his recent visit to Guantanamo, which was the subject of last week's cover story of The New Republic. His government-guided tour included a chance to witness the interrogation of a detainee. Before visiting Guantanamo, he was told what to expect by the chief counsel of the Office of Military Commissions, Colonel Dwight Sullivan.
He said, okay, here's what you're going to see. You're going to go and you're going to see a detainee in a Lazy Boy chair, and he will be having McDonald's fries from the McDonald's on the base, and it'll be very jolly, and this will be designed to show you how amicable the interrogations are. So imagine my surprise when we walked into Camp 5, which is one of the recently constructed prisons, modeled after a maximum security prison in Indiana, I think, if I recall. And there was the Lazy Boy chair, and there's a VCR DVD player. We were told that the detainees often watch movies with the interrogators to relax before the interrogation. Harry Potter, it turns out, is especially popular. And then we were taken into a separate room to watch a closed-circuit television broadcast of an interrogation taking place. And there it was. There was the smiling detainee in the Lazy Boy, and our guide said, "Ah, you just missed it. They just had lunch. They had Subway sandwiches from the base, and they were just taken away." So this has been a long-running show, and in fact, the New York Times reported in 2005 that journalists complained that on a series of trips, the same tableau of the interrogator and the McDonald's fries or the fast food had been presented, leading some to charge that these were fake interrogations. Whether they're real or fake, it seemed to me that the conditions of the interrogation didn't get to the real objection to Gitmo right now. The real objection is not the conditions of the interrogation, but the procedures that are used to detain people indefinitely, to decide who gets in and who gets out, and now we see to try people for their lives.
What are the trials at Gitmo supposed to be examining?
Well, for example, Mr. Hamdan, who is accused of being Osama bin Laden's driver, and in the course of that task of furthering his terrorist aims, will be tried before a military commission. I'm not sure what the precise charge is. When he was tried under conspiracy the last time, the Supreme Court said that charge was essentially invented and therefore couldn't stand. But now that Congress has endorsed the commissions, Hamdan will be tried again of abetting terrorism in some form. And once again, the constitutionality of the tribunals will be challenged. I should say, I'm happy to boast here, the Hamdan's last case was argued and won by my brother-in-law, Neil Katyal. Neil will be challenging the new commissions as well, which were recently upheld by the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, and that may go up to the Supreme Court this spring, and we'll have another round of seeing whether or not these new commissions are or are not constitutional.
Is it awkward to go on a press junket like this, knowing that you are being shown only things that the military wants you to see, and you're being treated like very well, which is a good thing. So you are getting a very subjective view of things at Gitmo, and you walk away wondering. At least I think you suggested you walked away wondering: is any of this staged? How much of this is typical of what goes on there?
Yes, it was very awkward. I really can't overestimate the power of a private flight and a warm omelet, 60,000 feet in the air. It's very easy to succumb to just the cushiness of being coddled and the excitement of being chosen as part of this small group. And also, I have to say, I was impressed in my private off-the-record conversations with the general counsel of the Defense Department, who seemed like a intelligent and well-meaning person. So it's very easy to get caught up in the giddy sense of seeing something special, but my response to that was just not to make any judgments at all about whether or not what we were seeing was responsible. I feel like I've got no way of judging whether it was staged or not, whether we were seeing things selectively or not. There was nothing two-sided about this tour. My goal in the article was to describe it as neutrally as possible, and then to talk more specifically about the problems with the military commission rules that seemed to me objectively troubling.
As you pointed out, your brother-in-law represented one of the men who was imprisoned at Gitmo. And you describe what it's like for lawyers to have to travel to Gitmo to see their clients, and you describe it as like a really grueling trip. And it was just interesting to contrast that with this like lovely flight with the personally made omelet that you had on the press junket.
It sure was. Neil was amused, to say the least, when he heard about our cushy flight, because he had a very different one. He had to get up at 12:30 in the morning, drive to Virginia, get on a plane, go through hours of military security in order to get on the base. His research assistants were given a hard time too. Then you fly to Jacksonville, you refuel for 8 hours, fly to Gitmo, and have to wait hours more for a 3-minute security briefing before finally being taken onto the base. They did not make it easy for habeas lawyers to see their clients there, and the contrast reminded me very starkly about the fact that I wasn't going to trust everything that I saw and take it at face value.
Jeffrey Rosen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen's article on Gitmo was the cover story of last week's edition of The New Republic, where he's the legal affairs editor. Coming up, a CIA agent who was stationed in Africa during the Cold War. This is Fresh Air. I didn't do it, says former CIA agent Larry Devlin, referring to what he describes as the erroneous belief that he was behind the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. Devlin became the CIA station chief in the Congo in July 1960, just 10 days after the Congo received its independence from Belgium and Patrice Lumumba became the first elected prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Just a few weeks later, Lumumba's government was overthrown in a coup led by the head of the Congo's army, Joseph Mobutu. Lumumba was arrested by Mobutu's men and later murdered under mysterious circumstances. Mobutu remained head of the army until 1965, when he led another coup and took over as president. Larry Devlin has been credited with or blamed for involvement in that coup, but he insists he was not consulted or in any way involved. This was during the Cold War, when many African countries were involved in proxy wars between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Mobutu was seen as sympathetic to the West, Lumumba as leaning toward the Soviets. Larry Devlin tells his story in the new memoir, Chief of Station, Congo. He says that although he wasn't involved with the assassination of Lumumba, he was actually assigned with that task. He received a message from CIA headquarters that a person identifying himself as Joe from Paris would arrive in 1960. Here's what happened when Joe from Paris arrived.
He told me that he had had instructions, he had received instructions to tell me that I was to assassinate Patrice Lumumba. I'd been in the business by that time over 11 years, and I'd never heard of such a thing happening, and I certainly did not want to become involved. But I listened to him. I said, on whose instructions do you give me these orders? And he said, the instructions come from the President Eisenhower. And I said, did you hear him? Did he give those instructions to you? And he said, no. I heard that from Dick Bissell. Dick Bissell, at that time, had the title of Deputy Chief of Operations. Deputy Chief Plans, excuse me, at that time was his title. Bissell had assured Joe from Paris that this was the case and that he was to carry out these instructions. Joe from Paris happened to be a very competent and highly regarded chemist. And he pulled out a little package and said, you should have this, and it has the various poisons which you can use. And he explained each one to me. The one I remember easiest was it was in a toothpaste. And all I had to do was get the toothpaste into the Lumumba's bathroom, and when he washed his teeth the next time, it would take care of him. My immediate reaction was, I don't like this operation. One, it's not necessary. Two, it's morally wrong. Three, there's a great danger to the United States and to CIA specifically, my organization, because if I fail in this and am caught, it's just going to cause a bonfire all around the world. And all of Africa will turn against us. So will much of Europe, so will much of Asia, particularly South Asia. It just seemed to be wrong.
Okay, so you thought this was morally wrong and that it would backfire on the United States and the CIA, but Joe from Paris told you that the president had ordered you to do this. So what did you do?
I used that old bureaucratic operation of stalling. I didn't say no. I didn't jump with joy either, of course, but I didn't indicate that I did not approve, because as I knew that if I refused, I would be recalled immediately, and that someone else would be sent out who would be willing to take on the job. I felt that I already had some very good operations going, and that person would perhaps not be prepared to pay attention to them and would only concentrate on the elimination of Lumumba.
What effect has it had on your life to be associated with this assassination, even though you say you didn't carry it out?
Indeed, I did not carry it out. I repeat the fact that I did not carry it out. It's not been easy, because there have been, you know, people, I think people sometimes, when they hear that I was the chief of station Congo when Lumumba was murdered, and they've heard that CIA allegedly was supposed to have killed him, and they think that that's probably what happened, people get a little bit nervous about being near me, I suspect. Although, little by little, that sort of has disappeared with history. After all, that was 47 years ago.
Although you say you didn't assassinate Lumumba, you did cooperate in the coup that removed him from office. You made
That's
a deal
true.
With Mobutu, who wanted to overthrow him, and did. There were two Mobutu coups. This was the coup in the early 60s. What was the deal?
The deal was, he just said that he wanted to, my guarantee that the United States government would recognize the government which he planned to put in power if and when he went ahead with this coup plan, but he would not go ahead with the plan unless he was guaranteed that the United States government would recognize this new government.
And you gave him America's guarantee?
I did not have the authority to do so, but I thought, well, this is what I've been instructed to do to get... It's not instructed to do, but I'd already had instructions before the assassination man came up that we should try and do anything to remove Lumumba from power. So I thought, this will contribute to that. And if it's decided in Washington that we do not wish to support a military coup, then I'll have ample opportunity to contact him, because he won't be doing it for at least a week.
So I should say, just to clarify, there were two Mobutu coups. This was the first one in the early 60s.
This was September 60, 14th September 60, and the next one was the 24th of November 1965.
There were so many proxy wars in Africa in the 60s and 70s, in which, the Soviets were backing one side and the Americans another side. And in the Congo, when you were there, Mobutu was seen as being friendly to America and the West. Lumumba, who was assassinated, was seen by the United States as being more sympathetic to the Soviet Union. So the United States backed Mobutu. And he, you know, a lot of people say he turned his country in the intervening years into a paradigm of everything that went wrong in post-colonial Africa. So in retrospect, do you think it was a mistake for the United States to support him?
No, I do not. At the time, I certainly felt very strongly that that Lumumba was a danger indirectly to the United States, because the Soviets were very clearly setting out to establish a position of, if not of control, at least of great influence within the country. Their objective was always control, but if they failed in that, at least to develop great interest, influence. And it was part of my job to try and prevent that. In fact, it was a very key factor in my assignment.
But in the process, the Congo ended up with a long rule by Mobutu, who turned into quite a dictator.
Yes, he became it was certainly not a purely... he had all the trappings of a democratic government, but it was he was the key factor. He was, if you will, a dictator. But no different than so many of the African countries at that time, or that existed at that time, or that have come to power since then. When he took power, I really believed, and I think he was certainly, he was only 29, he really believed in his country. He was unhappy to see the Soviets in the military camp authorized by the prime minister to attack, say that the only true democracy in the world was the Soviet Union and they had to be friends with the Congo and et cetera, along that line, typical Soviet propaganda. I think he was a nationalist. He'd worked on an underground newspaper before the independence, seeking independence, and as he put it to me the night we made our we had our talk, he said, you know, I don't want to give up one colonial master for another.
When you were the head of station for the CIA in the Congo, what was your official identity there?
I was a consul of the United States because I was assigned to this post shortly before independence when it was a consulate general. So when I went out as a consul, and remained that such. Happily, I had there was a legitimate, if you will, a foreign service officer who served as my vice consul, who handled all the paperwork and issuing of visas and that sort of thing.
I'm going to ask you a question that I feel like I need to ask. Because as a spy, you're so good at deception, because that's part of what you have to do, should we believe everything that you're telling us? Do you know what I mean? It's like I'm always so wary of interviewing former CIA agents because you just I always feel like if you've made your career deceiving people, how do I know that you're absolutely telling the truth now?
Well, I think you have to sort of start with the assumption that possibly I might be telling the truth, which indeed I am at this time. That was one reason for writing my book, mm-hmm. is that I get tired of hearing all sorts of things that I allegedly had done. You know, I'm accused of doing all sorts of things. There's been a book recently, few years ago, which I'm referred to as the murderous Larry Devlin. I got tired of that. That's why I wrote the book. When I joined the service, it was because I had originally planned to try and teach at the university level. I'd obtained my master's degree and completed all the coursework required for the doctorate and was preparing to write my dissertation when one of my professors asked me to drop in on a Sunday and he said he had someone he wanted me to meet, and it turned out it was McGeorge Bundy, who later became the National Security Advisor for Presidents Kennedy and President Johnson. He was there attempting to recruit people that he felt would fit into this new organization, the CIA. I accepted because I was impressed. He made the point that we had to fight a Cold War in order to avoid a hot war. And having been involved in a hot war for all too long, I went through the Mediterranean and European campaigns in World War II. I agreed that we had to do anything to avoid anything we could do to avoid an atomic war was fair game, and I therefore enlisted. So I felt that what I was doing was a good thing. All that is, except of course when I was requested to assassinate someone that I did not approve of.
And speaking of that order that you assassinate Patrice Lumumba when you were station chief for the CIA in the Congo, who did give the order? Do you know now? You were told that the president, President Eisenhower, had given the order, but do you really know for sure now
no,
who gave it?
No, I do not know for sure. As many of your listeners may be aware, when it came out in 1975, President Ford made him slip of tongue and let go that the CIA had been involved in assassination matters. And it became a very, both a political and a congressional problem. The Senate appointed a special committee headed by Senator Church to investigate the matter. I've read most of the reports that were produced by that committee, and it seems quite clear that I think, if you remember, there was a king of England who said, "Once will no one rid me of that priest?" Speaking of a matter, this is a historic matter. Well, I think probably the president must have indicated that he was dissatisfied with the fact that Lumumba was still there in office and we hadn't found a way to remove him from office. In any case, it was interpreted by Dick Bissell, who was then the deputy director of plans, mean that the president wanted him assassinated. Now, during the meeting of the committee, met for some weeks, the president's, Mr. Gray, who was the president's national security advisor at that time, said absolutely not, the president never would have done such a thing. Other people who were present at the meeting where he is alleged to have indicated he wanted him something done said they interpreted that any means, fair or foul, to get rid of him.
So you still don't really know whether there really was such an order or whether it was just a misinterpretation of something the president said?
No, I don't. You have it exactly. It could have been, he could have made it, the decision, the order, have extended the order, or it could have been a misinterpretation.
My guest is former CIA agent Larry Devlin. His new memoir is called Chief of Station Congo. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Larry Devlin, and he's written a book about when he was chief of station for the CIA in the Congo. Now, the way you described it, you joined the CIA out of idealistic reasons, and you know, you wanted to prevent a hot war from breaking out. Was it difficult to remain idealistic in the kinds of situations you were put in the Congo?
I did not have any problem about that. I felt that I was doing what was necessary. I was contributing, not doing. I was not by myself achieving this. The Soviet efforts to move into the Congo were viewed both by Washington and by me and by the ambassador. Most of the people, I believe, in the embassy felt the same thing, that the Soviets were making a major effort to take over the Congo in an effort to take over as much of Africa as they could to gain control of it. The object of, if you will, long-term object might have been, we didn't know, but it seemed a likely possibility, that if they could get further north from the Congo, they could get into position where they would put planes and rockets in such a position as to outflank NATO on the south. In other words, to control they could control militarily the Mediterranean.
What's it like to spend many years doing work that you can't really tell anybody about?
Well, it's sometimes a bit difficult particularly when you have a family. I can recall it when I would come home sometime and tell my wife that, oh, so-and-so, someone was a friend or someone with whom we'd served abroad, had just been made an ambassador or a deputy chief of mission, whatever the title they'd recently achieved. And I'd look over at my poor daughter would sort of be looking down. I knew what she was thinking. Everybody gets promoted but my daddy.
She didn't understand that was just a cover.
No, she felt so sorry for me.
My dad's a loser.
Yes. And later, when she was so happy when she found out where I worked, that I wasn't...
When were you able to tell her that?
Well, actually, she learned quite young. She was only, I don't remember, in her early teens, when we were going back to my second tour in the Congo, and my wife and daughter took a physical elsewhere, not at the CIA. And at the end, when they turned in the papers and forms they'd filled out, etc., the woman said, "What cover is your husband under? State, Army, Navy, aid, or something like that?" So she kept, afterwards, my daughter kept saying, "What does she mean, what is Daddy's cover? What does this mean? What does this mean?" She was... So when I got home that night, my wife said, "You must talk to your daughter about the facts of life." And I said, "No, I'd rather have you do that." And she said, "No, not those facts. Where you work." And so I had a little talk with my daughter, and she was just delighted. I think she thought I was 007 or something like that. And she was, to the best of my knowledge, she never revealed where I worked or did anything like that. And as you may have noticed if you read my book, that the fact she saved my wife's life and my life on two occasions.
Well, it's good to have a brave daughter.
I do indeed. I'm very, very proud of her.
Larry Devlin, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure to be here, Terry. I have listened to your program so many times. I have enjoyed it many, many times. And I never expected to be interviewed by you, but I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Larry Devlin's CIA memoir is called Chief of Station Congo. You can now download podcasts of Fresh Air on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day. In stores and online at bn.com. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Gospel of Judas and the Shaping of Christianity. We talk with religion scholars Elaine Pagels and Karen King. Their new book translates and interprets the recently discovered Gospel of Judas. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.